Welcome to an all-new Off the Wall on YesNetwork.com. Chris Sheeran and Joe Auriemma give their opinions on the latest happenings surrounding Yankees baseball, as well as dive into the hottest topics in the sports world. And now, here are your hosts, Chris Sheeran and Joe Auriemma.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Off the Wall podcast. It is our maiden voyage with the new equipment here in the YesNetwork.com office. It's no longer in my office. It's Chris Sheeran. It's Joe Auriemma. And a special guest today is Eric Boland. Mr. Boland, how are you?
I'm good, Chris. Joe, how are you guys?
Oh, we're great. We're great.
We don't have to pass a mic back and forth.
I know,
we're
fantastic. We're actually talking at the same time, which is great.
Eric. And only the audience can benefit from that.
Yes, they can. Eric, before we get to the Yankees, I mean, there has to be if I had to pick anyone out there in the Twitterverse, in the sports world altogether, that couldn't have been more upset that the Jets waived Tim Tebow, it's Eric Boland.
That's the question?
Yes.
Well, where to begin? It's humorous to say the least. I mean, I've always been amazed how Woody Johnson basically sort of escaped the for lack of a better word, blame for what went down there. I mean, he's a guy that very clearly was on the record about, he wants headlines, he wants attention, he wants a superstar quarterback, he wants a star quarterback, he likes the whole Broadway Joe thing, and that's great if the guys can play.
Right.
The one way to knock the Giants off the back pages, if you remember, a little more than a year ago, because they were coming off another surprising Super Bowl run, the one way to do it was to sign the most polarizing figure in sports.
Hire Barnum and Bailey.
Sports overall. And, if you don't think that was driven somewhat by the attention-hungry owner, I think you're naive. So how Tannenbaum took the fall for that and said all the right things, I'll never understand. But, you sign a guy that can't play the position, and then lo and behold, you find out he can't play the position. I think all of this was very, very predictable going back a year and a half. The coaching staff clearly didn't really want him. I love the narrative that somehow, the coaching staff, once they had him in, didn't know what to do with him. I think, when somebody is forced upon you that you don't want, I think that's usually the result.
I think Skip Bayless would disagree with you. Skip Bayless thinks that this guy is the greatest quarterback ever to play the game. And actually, I heard ESPN's going to do a 3-hour special on the decision. It's now, instead of LeBron James, it's Tim Tebow's decision on whether he's going to play in Canada or in the Arena League. So that's ESPN's going live to that now, I heard.
Is that reference to the Omaha Beef?
Yes. The Omaha Beef.
Operas call it opportunity. The shame of it is, and in all seriousness, Tim Tebow isn't the problem himself.
No.
The problem is his cult-like fans that literally do think he walks on water, and certain enablers in the media, including people who traffic in manufactured debate and outrage just to get attention for a show that very few watch. Hitching their wagon to Tebow because of who he is, and driving the discourse so much to where he becomes as polarizing as he is. So that's really the shame of it, because all accounts, again, in all seriousness, is that Tebow is a wonderful guy who was in a bad situation.
Absolutely.
Now the one caveat to that is that, Tebow did have a choice where he went last year, because Jacksonville was offering the same deal to the Broncos that the Jets were, from everything that I read. And Jacksonville was prepared to make him the starting quarterback, whereas the Jets, he could come in and compete. And he chose to come to New York. And that was, I think that's one thing that in all of the woe is Timmy Tebow stuff that I read and heard when he got released, nobody talked about that. He did choose to come to New York, so he is somewhat culpable as well.
Hey, Eric, you brought up the Omaha Beef, so if people didn't hear about this, their quarterback, his name is James McNear. He threw 21 touchdown passes, only 2 interceptions through 6 games so far for the Beef in their indoor football league. He thinks he could even help Tebow. He said, quote, "I think Tim can learn a lot from me." That's from McNair, the quarterback of the Omaha Beef, and they offered Tebow $75 a game to come out and play with them. I don't think that's going to happen. And you know what? Let's get serious for a second. If he really wants to play quarterback and he really wants to come back into the NFL, there's nothing wrong with him going up to the Canadian Football League and proving that he could play a little quarterback. It's a wider field. You know, it's a lot less stressed in the NFL, that's for sure. I agree with everything you said, and I don't believe that he's been made such a polarizing figure here in the NFL. He did lead the Broncos to that one playoff win over the Steelers in overtime on that slant pattern that he threw about 10 yards in the air, and then it was taken 70 the rest of the way. But here's my thing. I just want to get your thoughts on this, too, before we move on to baseball. You know, on that Jet team last year, can you find, and I know he wasn't the best quarterback on the team, but look at that roster, look at what they had, and see if you could find me a guy with more championship quality and more heart than that kid has on that sideline.
Well, no, I mean, that's probably the fairest point, is that even if you are a coaching staff that didn't want Tim Tebow, with the utter lack of playmakers on that offense, not to give and an opportunity to succeed, you know, certainly is, you know, negligence, coaching negligence 101, probably.
Right, 71
but
plays.
Again, you know, but again, you can't force the old square peg into a round hole. I mean,
no, that's
can't throw the ball. He can't
right,
throw the
that's
ball.
That's a great point.
Whole, you know, this whole notion of the Wildcat offense, you know, revolutionizing offense. That's not what, you know. There's a reason Tony Sperano got fired in Miami. The Wildcats worked 1 year. NFL defense has adjusted, which they've been doing for 70 years with this stuff. And, you know, there's no counter-adjustment with the Wildcats. There's a reason nobody runs it.
I just hope someone comes out.
The notion that the Jets were going to run it all of last year with Tim Tebow was a joke.
It was a total joke.
I always come back to the whole owner thing and put it squarely on Woody Johnson.
Yeah, I just hope someone comes out with the tell-all in a couple of years.
Absolutely. Eric, we are going to switch gears, and we're going to talk about something that you and I cover every day, the New York Yankees and baseball right now. And, Eric, you know, looking at this Yankee team, nine guys on the disabled list to start the season. A lot of critics said that this was going to be the year where the Yankees finally took their big fall. But after 1 month of baseball, 16-10 after 26 games, with the likes of Travis Hafner and Lyle Overbay and Vernon Wells, and great starting pitching, and you'd have to say that this was really a successful start that the Yankees can just only hope that they can continue into May once they start getting players back.
Joe, I don't think you could have envisioned a better start, better first month for the Yankees based on everything that you just said with the nine guys on the disabled list and really the way a dark cloud kind of settled over this team before pitchers and catchers even reported it. There were a variety of reasons for that, but that dark cloud just only got darker once the game started and you had the injuries to Phil Hughes right out of the gate and to Curtis Granderson right away, and then a week or so after that, Mark Teixeira goes down right before the WBC. You know, there were, you know, low expectations and really almost no expectations for this team. And for them to come out and go 16-10 in the first month, you know, there's nobody with the Yankees who wouldn't have signed up for that if you had posed that to them on the eve of the April 1st opener against the Red Sox. So, you know, look, I mean, the one thing that everyone agreed on who you know, had opinions on the Yankees and everyone did in the preseason, even the fiercest critics did say, and I do like their pitching staff, though. And that has been the one element that, you know, save for a couple of guys, has been really consistent for them. And that's what's enabled them to, you know, if you're going to, you know, target a primary reason for the 16-10 start, it's definitely the starting pitching. And the bullpen, for the most part, has been as good as what people thought it would be, too. You know, you throw in some guys like Wells and certainly Travis Hafner that have been better than people anticipated. And you know, it's added up to a surprising and a very satisfactory first month if you're a Yankee fan.
Eric, let's go back to the pitching staff there. You brought up Hafner, who's been really hot for the Yankees at the outset. They're not playing him every day. They're only playing him against right-handed pitching. You know, you don't want to get him hurt, too. He's had his history with injuries. You're from the Cleveland area. I'm sure you followed Prunk's career the whole entire time. But I want to go back to the pitching for a second here and bring up Phil Hughes, a guy that started out in his first two outings. He threw seven innings total. Since then, you know, he's gone into the sixth or deeper for the Yankees. What's been the difference there that you've seen, Eric, in Phil Hughes, those first two and his last three?
Well, you know, say the obvious one, Chris, is not the frequency with which balls are leaving the yard has decreased significantly. But look, I mean, we sometimes in the media get tired of, cliche answers from guys, but it's really fastball command for him. You know, most pitchers, everything is based on how they're commanding their fastball. And for a guy like Phil Hughes, who, you know, pitches up in the zone anyway when on his best days, if he's just a little bit off, that's why he gives up the amount of home runs that he does. He's been much better commanding the ball out of the gate. And he's, you know, had some good fortune as well, where when he has missed up in the zone, guys haven't hit it. But, I think with Hughes, I know what the expectations were for this guy 6-7 years ago. Everyone anticipated he was going to be a front of the rotation guy.
Right.
I think it's clear he probably never is going to be that. But if you look at things outside of the vacuum with him, as a fourth starter, what he's produced when he's been healthy has been pretty good. He's as big a reason as anyone with the Yankees' good start the first month of the season. Probably not as big as Hiroki Kuroda or Sabathia, for that matter, or up until the other night, Andy Pettit. But as a number four starter, I don't think you can ask for much more than what he was giving them. And if he stays healthy and makes 30, 35 starts, and, you know, post 16 wins, 17 wins, I don't think you can ask much more than that.
And you mentioned CC Sabathia there in passing. Let me go there. The velocity hasn't been there at the outset of the season. What do you think? Is it him coming back from the elbow surgery? He says he feels okay, but he definitely does not look like, you know, vintage CC Sabathia, where he's able to go out there. The velocity's down. He's had to battle through starts to get wins. What have you seen out of him so far this season?
I don't think anything different than anyone else has seen. I mean, it's not a non-story. I know that, you know, because of what happened with Michael Pineda last year and the constant daily questions about velocity, the word velocity is taken on sort of a negative connotation, and the Yankees and Joe Girardi in particular don't like to talk about it. But Sabathia is a story because here's a guy who's been consistently a mid-90s guy his whole career, and his average fastball, you know, usually rests in that 93-mile-an-hour zone. That hasn't been there this year, and I was surprised a couple of weeks ago. Sabathia was very candid that, hey, it may not come back. I'm in my approaching mid-30s now, and every power pitcher goes through this where they just don't throw the ball as hard as they did when they were 25, 26, 27 years old, and it's inevitable. It's going to happen, and maybe it's happening to me. But he was also very quick to say, that doesn't mean I can't win games. And he used Mariano as an example. He used Andy Pettit as an example, who, you know, seemingly can get away with throwing 83, 84, 85 because he can throw it exactly where he wants. And I think CC Sabathia is that caliber of pitcher as well, to where this is who he is as a guy whose fastball is going to top out around 91, maybe 92 on a good day, that he still is crafty enough to get guys out and still anchor a pitching staff, because he does have four pitches that he can go to, and generally he's got command of all of them and can put them where he wants and needs to. So, he said, if this is who I am, I'll deal with it and I'll still win.
Absolutely, Eric. And, you know, one thing that, you know, we've seen pitchers go through this transition. In fact, Mike Mussina, some years back, had that one down year where he basically, his stuff wasn't the same. It wasn't what it once was. And then he, you know, came back and had that 20-win season because he basically just learned how to pitch. He wasn't a fireballer anymore, but he was very crafty. And that's the same thing you see out of CC Sabathia, where, you know, even on nights where, you know, his fastball was topping out at 89, 90 miles an hour earlier in the season, he still has great stuff. So he's got movement on that fastball. He's got movement on all of his other pitches, and that's really what it's all about. A lot of times people mistake, you know, the high velocity. You could have a 97-mile-an-hour fastball, but if it's flat, it's going to go out of the ballpark. But if you have movement on your stuff, that's really where it's an advantage. I mean, what would you say about, you know, Sabathia and possibly, you know, just becoming more of a crafty pitcher as his career goes on?
Yeah, I mean, I, and again, he mentioned the name a couple of weeks ago, the guy that lockers to his left in the Yankees clubhouse, Andy Pettitte. And Pettitte has said that he feels he's a better pitcher. And Pettitte has said that the last couple of years.
Yeah.
That he became a better pitcher after he had the elbow surgery when he was with the Astros because, you know, he no longer could throw the ball as hard as he did the first decade or so, decade or more of his career, and that forced him to find other ways. And that was to really refine the cutter into the weapon that it is.
Yeah.
And a couple of his other pitchers. But most importantly, be able to throw them at any count and exactly where he wants to throw it pretty much every time. And that's what CC Sabathia is going to have to do, and he's more than confident that he'll be able to do that. And,
yeah.
And we've seen that he is able to do that. You know, up until, you know, he had his bad first start of the year, but then he reeled off three straight, and his fastball was barely cracking 90 miles an hour.
Absolutely.
And he looked really good in shutting down some pretty good lineups in winning three in a row. So, I mean, I have no doubt that, you know, I'm not totally convinced Sabathia's velocity is gone and the days of 95 are completely gone.
Right.
But it's looking increasingly like that may be the case. And, you know, I still don't think there's any reason he can't be the ace of the staff and pitch and honor that title. I mean, it's one thing to be called the ace, but you also have to actually produce. That he can't continue to do that pitching at 91 miles an hour because, you know, he's got the diversity of pitches and the command of them to do that.
Yeah, and, you know, another guy that's just been, you know, you mentioned it before, that's been amazing for this Yankee staff, Hiroki Kuroda. You know, he came here last year, you know, gets the 16 wins. The one thing that we've seen out of him is that he's just the model of consistency. You look at his, you know, his five decisions this year, you know, after that, you know, his opening game loss where he went 1 1/3 and, you know, came out of the game, you know, he's 4-0 with just above a 1.8 ERA. And even the last two starts, Eric, you know, he hasn't had his stuff to start the game, and he's just battled through, and he's given the Yankees exactly what they needed. And I actually wrote last night that, to me, the Yankees have two aces on this staff. I think Sabathia is the horse, and Kuroda has just, you know, become the Yankees' battler here, and I think he's truly become one of the best pitchers, not just in the American League, but really in all of baseball at the advanced age of 38.
I think that's a very good way of putting it, Joe, with them having two aces, because if you do look at last year, if you evaluate the season from pillar to post for the Yankees, the ace of their staff last year was Hiroki Kuroda. He was their most consistent pitcher. I remember a bad first start in Tampa, and a second start wasn't great. But then he was awesome the rest of the year for the most part. Of course, he had a hiccup here and there, but that's going to happen to any pitcher. But he was their most consistent and best pitcher all of last season, and he's off to that kind of start this year. And you talk to guys in the clubhouse or talk to other scouts from other teams, nights like last night actually impressed them more than nights when he goes out and he's got his great stuff, because a lot of pitchers are not able to make it through, you know, the early innings or give you five or six innings when they don't have their best stuff. They can't do it for whatever reason, and mentally it's too difficult for them. Kuroda was awful by his own admission, and he called his two bread and butter pitches. He said they were pretty useless, a sinker and slider last night. He
yeah.
used that phrase, that they were useless to him his first three innings. He had nothing in his first three, somehow kept the Astros, and of course, you know, the Astros are awful. But the reality is, we saw it the other night against Andy Pettitte, you know, if your pitcher doesn't have it, any Major League Baseball team is going to hit you. Kuroda kept him off the scoreboard, and that really is what impresses other players when you talk to them about Hiroki Kuroda, is that he consistently, when he does go out there without his best stuff, can turn in performances like he gave you last night, where, you know, you look up, he's thrown a ton of pitches, but somehow you know, only one or two runs have come across, and then he's able to settle down, and he's a totally different pitcher the last three or four innings than he was from the first three or four. Making those mid-game adjustments is something only a select few and the best pitcher is able to do. And, you know, Hiroki Kuroda, you know, obviously has proven in his time in the major league that he should be, you know, considered an elite pitcher. He doesn't make those lists when people talk about it, but, you know, if you look at the performance and the numbers and throw the wins and losses out the window, but the ERA and walks and hits per innings and those numbers that really mean something, not the wins and losses, you know, he is an elite pitcher.
Yeah.
It's the Off the Wall podcast. Chris Shear and Joe Auriemma talking to Eric Boland, of course, the beat writer for the Yankees for Newsday. Eric, I want to spin it to these injuries that we were talking about in the beginning. You can't really ignore the injury bug when you talk about the Yankees. When the Yankees come on, yes, it should be the MASH theme music pretty much. Mm. And B.J. Honeycutt and, you know, Hawkeye Pierce and Hot Lips Houlihan should be in the credits. But it's been that kind of a season so far for the Yankees. Now Kevin Youkilis goes down. Corbin Joseph comes up. You know, this isn't really the bombastic lineup that the Yankees could say they've had the past couple of years, but a team that wasn't supposed to hit a lot of home runs this year is in second place in the major leagues with 36 behind the Braves 38. It's just amazing when you think about it what the Yankees have been able to do, basically smoke and mirrors with Lyle Overbay in the lineup, with Vernon Wells, who had the great spring training with the Angels, then came over to the Yankees. And make no mistake, you know, Brian Cashman has taken a lot of flack for some of the moves he's made over the years.
Rightfully so.
He had Jarrett Wright as one of them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he has done the past 3 or 4 years with the bench and bringing these guys in and getting the right puzzle pieces to fit in where he needs them. He's just done a tremendous job, and that's been one of the reasons why this team has been able to stay afloat. Do you agree with that?
There's no question. And really the hat tip in that regard, it goes primarily to his pro scouting department, because they're the ones that are making the recommendations saying that, you know, hey, and going back a couple of years, hey, Andrew Jones has a little something left.
Right.
Hey,
Eric Chavez
has, mm-hmm. has a little bit something left. Hey, let's trade for Chris Stewart. He's capable backup. And make these recommendations. And, you know, looking at the all the guys that you just mentioned for this past off season and during the spring with Overbay and Bosch and Hafner, those bit signings that pretty much, you know, if you go to Twitter or Yankee message boards, those signings all get made fun of, and everybody runs from them now and pretends they were with them all along. But go back and read some of the comments when Hafner got signed and when they traded for Wells and when they brought on Bosch and all that. They get pretty, and I'm not excluding the media from that with making
right.
a knee-jerk reaction either, but the moves for the most part have been universally panned and ridiculed. And by and large, you know, they generally turn out. So Cashman and his pro scouting department deserve a lot of credit for, unearthing these, the diamonds in the rough, so to speak, that, you know, have come in and been signed to perform minor roles. And in some cases have ended up, being very major for this team. Who's been bigger than Jason Nix?
Right.
Who's a guy who, no, he's not going to hit the ball, but he doesn't kill you when he's in the field. And he's, you know, guess what?
He's a ball player.
He's there every day, third baseman.
He's a ball player. He's absolutely a ball player. And thank you for setting me straight with the pro scouting department as well. I have to give props to them as well. So thank you for bringing that up, Eric.
Eric, I got to tell you, the one thing that I've really been impressed with as well, and Travis Hafner brought this up last night, is that, with these signings too, it's not just about the players that, you know, basically were cast aside and are given a rebirth here, but the players that the Yankees have signed in this, you know, in this offseason are great character guys as well. The clubhouse has been a great environment, and the one theme that I've noticed since we've been talking to a lot of these guys on a nightly basis is that Hafner said it, Wells has said it, Overbay has said it, they say it all the time, they're having fun. And that's been the theme of this team. It's a core of, you know, good veterans, good character players, and they're just having fun with the opportunity that they're given. And it really has made a difference, not in just the clubhouse, but with the team chemistry for a team basically that was put together just a couple of months ago.
And adding to that, Joe, and one of the things with these veteran guys, who are experiencing the Yankees for the first time in their career. There's a reason it's a destination if they can get, you know, to New York. And obviously the money has to be right, or in the case of Overbay, you know, nobody's offering you anyway, and it's a, you know, you're just happy to get a job, let alone with the Yankees. But they like the environment that exists, which is there's only one goal, and that's to win. And they know that they have the backing, you know, in Cleveland, just using Hapner as an example. You know, obviously, because of the market size and the ownership, it's not always for certain that the number one goal is to put a winning team on the field. There's other considerations. With the Yankees, there's no other considerations. Yeah, you can talk about the $189 million, and
right,
that certainly, you know, has been a legitimate issue the last couple of years, but you're still talking about a payroll of $189 million.
Definitely.
People, you know, talk about that. Sometimes I think they lose sight. They think they forget about the one in front of the 89. So a guy like Hapner and an Overbay and Wells, you know, they really like the, and we as the media sometimes criticize it, but for players, they love it, the button-down culture, the just-go-about-your-business culture of the Yankees. It doesn't always make for the most exciting of clubhouses for the media, but, you know, constructing a clubhouse isn't about the media, even though we sometimes like to think that it's all about us. it's about players being comfortable. It's about players, you know, being comfortable in their work environment and, you know, wanting to produce and wanting to go out every day and win and all that. And, you know, the fact is for the Hapners of the world and some of these veterans that we're talking about, you know, not every franchise is run the right way or run the same way the Yankees is. And I'm not saying the Yankees have exclusivity on the way they run their franchise, but players do like coming in here knowing that the overriding goal above anything else, and it goes from the top of the organization to the whatever you want to define at the bottom, is that the goal is to win.
Right.
And that they know that's the only thing really that ownership is interested in.
I want to piggyback on the point that Joe just brought up, Eric, and it was a great point. You know, you bring guys in like a Vernon Wells and a Travis Hafner and a Lyle Overbay, just great guys in the clubhouse. Then you take a look at a team like the Red Sox, who were a mess last year. They won 69 games. They get rid of all these big personalities, these big players. They send them to the Dodgers. Look at the Red Sox this year. You look at the Texas Rangers. They get rid of Josh Hamilton and they lose him in free agency. He goes to the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. All of a sudden, Texas is leading the AL West. Does that shock you that all these big-name guys, is it because of the clubhouse? Is it because they bring such these big personalities to the clubhouse that these teams have these problems with maybe so many players? And I bring up the Marlins from last year as well. They were built to win a World Series last year, and they were disbanded before the season was over, pretty much.
You know, Chris, I think it's simpler than that, and I just go to this. Look at who the Rangers are throwing on the mound every day.
Pitching.
And look at who the Angels are throwing out there every day.
Right.
You know, the Angels have the second worst ERA in the American League.
Yes, they do.
The Astros. You know, you look at the teams that are off to good starts and that are winning and trace back why the Marlins were so bad last year. You know, the reality is that the Rangers know they can let Josh Hamilton go, but, you know, they've got a pitching staff like the Tampa Bay Rays, where no matter who they throw out there, they're confident they're going to get 6-7 innings, and the guy's going to give up 2 runs, and if he's off, maybe 4 runs. But you know, they'll still win their share of games in that case. But they know they're going to get a quality start pretty much every time out by all 5 guys, and the teams that are able to do that, and it's, you know, we opened the show talking about this with the Yankees. You know, the reason they're 16-10. Yes, they've gotten some production from guys that you might not have expected, but the reality is that they're pitching. You know, their guys are going 6-7 innings a game and giving up 2 or 3 runs, and they're in every game that way. And that's why the Rangers are able to sustain that type of loss, and it's why the Angels, despite that quote murderer's row lineup that they thought they put together out there, they're not winning because they're not pitching.
Yeah, they're scoring 8 runs and they're losing, for crying out loud.
Yeah. They gave up, 7-1 they were up the other day and lost.
Yeah.
And that's not the first time that's happened.
Well, we've got Eric Boland on Off the Wall here. You can follow him on Twitter, at eBoland11. Eric, your tweets are great. You're one of the best Yankees writers out there. You really are. If you check him out on Newsday, really, you're going to get the best of the best.
Twitter's even better.
Twitter, you're hilarious.
You get to see the real Eric in the Twitter.
the one thing I really miss is actually Carrig being on this beat as well, because the banter back and forth, which I know you still have, even though he's with the Mets, it really was a little Oscar and Felix going on with the two of you.
Yeah, well, no, we certainly we miss Mark on the Yankees beat. Although his replacement Andy McCullough is extremely funny as
yeah.
well. But yeah, Mark and I had a little tit for tat going on Twitter, certainly, and not as much so now. He's also a colleague, and as much as you can see how much pull I have at Newsday, because I certainly didn't recommend that. But be that as it may, they made the choice that they did, and in all seriousness, they made a good one. So yes, Mark is missed on the beat, but he's doing a great job for us covering the Mets.
Before we end this, I have to ask you. What about those Browns? Are we gonna see a rebuild here? What's going on with the Browns? I know they've been rebuilding for 10 years, but what's going on?
Yeah, really, and back further than that, 1999 when they came back to an expansion team.
So, yeah,
you know, look, guys. I mean, you guys have followed the NFL the same way I do, and it's been like this for a long, long time. It's a coach and quarterback league.
Yep. Yes,
and if you have if you have both of those elements, you're going to win. And if you have one of the two elements, if it's the quarterback, you're probably going to win. If you don't have either, you have no chance. And the Browns since 1999 have not had the combination of coach and quarterback.
It's funny you say that, because you go back to
hopefully that turns around soon.
You go back to that draft, and that's really what you can talk about with the Cleveland Browns, is McNabb goes number two after Tim Couch to the Browns. So, I mean, that's really – it really started with that pick, and it's really been gloom and doom in Cleveland since. But hopefully, it's such a great organization for such a great city. You'd like to see it really turn around, because it really is good for the NFL when the Browns are good. But I did joke around. I you did not say anything to me on Twitter the other night, but when the draft came out, I did say, with the sixth pick of the draft, the player has been notified that he was selected by the Browns and has elected to go back to college. So I was waiting for Eric Boland to come back at me, but he was classy, and he kept it classy.
Well, that's what we try to do on Twitter.
And then I have to bring up right before we go, Eric. First of all, I wish nothing but the best for the Browns. It's a great organization. It's a historic organization in the NFL. And it's about time that the damn team starts winning. So nothing but the best of luck to your Cleveland Browns. And I want to leave this to poke fun at the Jets really quick. When Pat Summerall died, I was going through a lot of things just to – learn a lot of things that I didn't know about Mr. Summerall. And I came across something that his former sidekick did in the booth. And was it Brookshire?
Brookshire, yeah.
Yeah, Tom Brookshire. He said, he comes up to him on the sidelines, "I think you'll get a kick out of this." I think it was a Jets-Browns game, actually. And Brookshire comes over to Summerall and says, "The Jets have won the toss and have elected not to play."
Yes, I think I've read that somewhere. And as a Browns fan, I can associate with that.
All right, buddy. We really appreciate the time today. It's Eric Boland of Newsday, at eBoland11 on Twitter. We really appreciate the time, and hopefully we can do this again really soon. Thanks, Eric.
I look forward to it. Joe, Chris, thanks so much.
The Off the Wall podcast comes to you each week on iTunes and YesNetwork.com. If you like what you're listening to, simply subscribe to the show on iTunes. And if you have an extra minute, leave a comment and rating.